FINRA's budget summary provides a unique, forward-looking view into FINRA's budget for the current calendar year, providing greater transparency into FINRA's operations and finances. On this episode of FINRA Unscripted, we learn more, including how sometimes a budget deficit isn't a bad thing. Welcome to FINRA Unscripted from Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Caitlin Kiernan. Today, I'm pleased to be joined by Todd DeGancy, FINRA's Chief Financial and Administrative Officer. Todd, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Caitlin. Good to be here.
Todd, you and your team just wrapped up the 2019 budget summary. So we wanted to have you on the show to talk through what this budget is. But I wanted to start with the basics. What is the budget summary and how is it different from the annual financial statement?
Good question. So let me start with the annual financial statement. First of all, that's for results that have already transpired. In other words, what we accomplished last year in terms of our financial returns. The annual financial report is a much more robust discussion of our financial returns. It includes a management discussion and analysis of what happened on a year-over-year basis. It also includes all the accounting footnotes and explanations behind the numbers. And those are audited financial statements that are opined on by our external auditors. So that's kind of like looking in your rearview mirror.
So is that kind of like when a public company reports earnings?
Absolutely. It's very similar to that. We are not a public company and we do not have quarterly earnings statements and those sorts of things, but it really is our annual report like any other public company issues as well. The operating budget that we put forward is, as you said, forward-looking. It's about where we plan to invest our time, money, and energies going into the year in front of us. So it's looking through your front windshield, if you will. And it reflects our strategies, it reflects our priorities, it reflects on those things that we think are necessary to tackle in 2019 and how we're going to spend our money accordingly is what that reflects.
So presumably the budget itself isn't new, but just last year we started publishing it for the first time. What prompted that decision?
Right. So our CEO, Robert Cook, when he first came here in 2016, started a listening tour of all of our stakeholders. And one common response continued to come back to us is that FINRA should be more transparent about where it's spending its money. In other words, share the budget with the industry. And that's what we've been trying to do, is be more transparent by sharing with the industry where we plan on spending our money and whether or not we're being good financial stewards. So that's why we are sharing it with the industry now, to increase transparency.
So you mentioned FINRA is not a public company, but it's also not a government agency. So where does the money for the budget come from?
Largely, the money comes from the industry. The industry funds FINRA. We have different types of revenues. We have what we call regulatory assessments. And that's where FINRA assesses member firms based upon the size of their firm, the amount of trading they do, how many registered reps they have. And those are annual bills, if you will, and those are charged each and every year. We also have what we call user fees that we charge, whether it be registration and disclosure or use of our arbitration forum. The industry seeks out FINRA to provide some service or some forum that they can tap into to continue to do their work. And finally, we have contract revenues where we provide regulatory service agreements for exchanges and other SROs. So it really is the industry that funds FINRA's budget, along with the exchanges where we have these regulatory service agreements.
Good to know. So I was reading the report and noticed that it says FINRA tries to keep revenue estimates conservative. Why is that?
Well, first and foremost, as we see the industry, we are in a no-growth industry. The number of firms is decreasing, not increasing. Volumes are erratic. They can be up, they can be down. It's hard to predict where the IPO market's going, where we also collect revenues from based on those volumes and that activity. So there's a combination of things that we believe, with the backdrop of a no-growth industry, as well as difficult to predict volumes in the marketplace in advance of those occurring, we tend to be conservative. We are also conservative with our revenue estimates in that we exclude fines from our revenues. We do not use fines to cover our operating expenses. And we do not plan on investment portfolio gains and losses as another source of revenues to fund our operations. So yes, one may conclude we are conservative with our revenue estimates.
So if fines are excluded and not included as part of the operating budget, how is that money handled?
Great question. As part of our transparency effort in sharing our budgets, we also shared our financial guiding principles. In other words, how do we run the place from a financial standpoint? Again, these are guardrails, as I commonly refer to them. And one of those guardrails is we do not use fines to support our operating costs or our expenses. But under certain circumstances, we define our guiding principles. We will use fine monies collected to support our capital spending. And our capital spending, as we've detailed out our guiding principles, could be because there's an SEC mandate that requires some investment in technology, or there's some strategic opportunities that effectively promote compliance, that effectively fall under the umbrella of investor protection, and effectively market integrity, carrying out our mission. And it's very well detailed in those guiding principles what those uses of the fine monies can be used for. And as part of that, we wait until the year ends, and then we add up all of our capital spending, and then management will make an assessment whether or not the use of our capital spending falls within the guidelines that we've defined for the uses of fines. And then we have the board look at that as well. And where there's agreement where we fell within those guidelines, we will then apply the fine monies to those expenditures. And the end product is we actually issue a fines usage report, which shares again with the industry and others how we've used the fine monies collected in the year just ended.
So we'll link to the budget summary in our show notes for anyone who wants to read the financial guiding principles in detail. But now I wanted to switch over to the actual budget for 2019 and maybe start with the elephant in the room. The budget projects a shortfall of $185 million, which will be drawn from reserves. To the average person, that probably seems like a pretty big hole. So I was wondering, are you worried about having a shortfall of that size?
I'm not worried, largely because one is consistent with our guiding principles that we will rely on our reserves before we take price increases. But that is what our guiding principle says we are going to use our reserve balances for. So we will draw down on the reserve balances in 2019 in lieu of price increases with the industry. But more importantly, I'm not worried about the drawdown on the reserves this year because we continue to look at ways to operate the place more effectively and efficiently. We're working on short-term and long-term strategies to shore up our financial sustainability. And I believe that looking back over the way we've managed expenses in the past, we can do a pretty good job of controlling those things we actually do control. So I believe we will get back to financial sustainability to the point where we're not looking at $185 million losses.
What drove the decision to depend on the reserves like that?
Great question. We had really good conversations with our board regarding the amount of reserves that we have. I mean, we have roughly $1.6 billion of reserves today as we speak. And effectively, to operate FINRA on an annual basis, if we were to receive zero revenues, we would have $1 billion of expenditures to cover. This truly is more of an art than a science, if you will, but the reserves today really serve two purposes for FINRA. One, it's that rainy day fund, right? Because we can never compromise our regulatory mission. And if the revenues dry up overnight, we still need to fund those responsibilities. It also serves as a strategic fund that allows FINRA to carry out, whether they be SEC mandates or other strategic opportunities that, again, further our mission of investor protection and market integrity. For example, in 2016, we made a significant investment to move our market regulation business to the cloud. And we did not raise prices for that. We did not have a call on capital from the member firms to fund that initiative. We funded it from these reserves. And had we not funded it from those reserves and made that movement to the cloud, we would not be able to carry out our surveillance functions that we have today. That being said, we believe that our reserve balance is more than adequate to cover FINRA or to support FINRA through a rainy day. We were also very sensitive to just increasing prices to the industry, since the industry is not growing by leaps and bounds either. So it was a combination of those two where we rationalized that there's a certain amount of room we could work with to knock down our reserves before we go forward and take any particular price increases.
So we learned you're not worried about the $185 million loss, which is good to hear, but is this a one-off type of loss, or do you see this as becoming something recurring?
Well, it could be recurring, but our reality is that we're continuing to look at this. As I mentioned, we're now working on short-term and long-term strategies to shore up our financial sustainability. And the good news is we have time. We have time to continue to work down the reserves and find the right solution to put into place, which may or may not be price increases, may or may not be other ways to achieve efficiencies in the business. So we're actually working with a group of the board members now and taking, as you call, a deep dive in trying to solve this. Because if volumes don't return or we do not receive positive returns on the investment portfolio, this could happen again. It could be recurring in nature. But on the other hand, I'm confident that as we've been able to demonstrate our ability to manage our expenditures and the fact that we haven't taken price increases in 6 years, my sense is somehow between expenses, volumes, and pricing, we'll be able to solve this.
As you just mentioned, there hasn't been an increase in 6 years. And I saw some reporting around the budget summary where people were suggesting that means price increases are imminent. Is that true?
Well, I'm not sure many businesses can survive for the long run not taking price increases. If you look at FINRA, we are a professional services organization comprised of people. And in order for us to continue to attract and retain the talent that we need to carry out our mission, yes, compensation increases will occur. If you look at what we've done over the past 3 years, we essentially have held our expenses flat. We've kept the line very tight on annual compensation increases. We've frozen bonuses for senior management and so forth. Those things that most organizations will do when it's in a belt-tightening type of environment. But you can only belt-tighten so long. And I think that price increases will be on the horizon. When that actually happens, the board will make that determination. But it'll be a combination of a couple things in how I envision them making that decision. One, are we operating as effectively as we possibly can? And two, are the reserves getting down to a level that no longer reflects that 1 year of expenditures, which is our floor?
But we're not at that level of reserves yet, so fee increases aren't coming tomorrow.
Correct. Fee increases are not coming in 2019.
So another thing I saw in some recent reporting around this budget summary was someone was quoted as saying the shortfall may result in a significant financial incentive to bring enforcement cases and impose fines. But you just said that fine money is not included in
right.
the budget. So just wanted to hear what you had to say about that.
Yeah, unfortunately, that statement's not accurate. In fact, if you looked at what the board has shared with the industry and our financial guiding principles, it's exactly the opposite of that statement. We do not use fine monies to run the business, fund compensation expenses, or whatever those expenses may be. We have strict parameters over the use of fine monies, and we even have strict approval procedures over the use of those fine monies. And then we're transparent by issuing the fines usages report with the industry. So I would suggest that the commenter should take a look at our financial guiding principles and maybe look at our fine usages report, and that should change your opinion.
So even though there's a budget shortfall, fines can't fill that based on how fine usage is defined?
That's correct. We're relying on our reserves.
So at the root of the budget shortfall for 2019 is the fact that FINRA's operating revenues are falling while operating expenses are expected to increase a bit more than prior years, 3.7% versus an average of 1.6% since 2015. What's driving that increase?
As we touched on briefly, it's the annual compensation increases for our employees. You know, as you think about it, as you said, back to 2015, that's a pretty good accomplishment. I think most people would agree that's a really good accomplishment to keep your expenses growing no more than 1% over the last 4 or 5 years. We've done that largely through our FINRA 360 initiative, where we focused on consolidating and or better coordinating our resources based on feedback from the industry, whether that be our enforcement programs or member supervision programs. As I've mentioned before, we've held compensation largely flat, but at some point in time, you can only do cost containment for so long before you begin to compromise your mission, in this case, compromise the attraction and retention of talent. So we are moving back to a period of some compensation increases, which are largely overseen by the board and are externally benchmarked, because FINRA's most important asset is its people. We're not making widgets. We're not selling things. It's really the expertise in the people that we put out there to carry out our mission. Again, we'll continue to have our focus on running as effectively and efficiently as we can, but it's a difficult revenue environment and our responsibilities remain robust. Our responsibilities are not shrinking. We need to continue to invest in our people, and that's what we're doing. And there's actually an increase in expenses in the 2019 budget because we're going to be increasing our training, our investment in our people as well, because we believe we need to develop their skills so we have the best trained people out there.
So one item in the budget is $18.3 million for external mandates, which mentions implementation costs related to the consolidated audit trail, but not costs incurred by FINRA as the plan processor. So people might wonder, why aren't the other fees that you expect to be incurred as a plan processor included?
We're actually still working on those. And actually, that is a budget that will be separate from FINRA's budget. We'll actually be creating a new subsidiary called FINRA CAT LLC, which will contain the budget, the operating expenses, and revenues for the consolidated audit trail. So it's just a little bit too early for me to give you a real answer if and when that information comes out.
Another area contributing to the increase appears to be real estate. FINRA is adjusting its New York footprint. Is FINRA leaving New York or what's changing?
No, FINRA is not leaving New York. What's changing is our 20-year leases are ending. So we've been spending time looking at our real estate needs, understanding where we can be most effective and efficient. So number one, we're looking to reduce our real estate needs by 25%. We roughly have 1,000 people in the New York area. And we're going to reduce that square footage, as I mentioned, by 25% going forward. We're also going to look to expand our existing regional offices in Long Island and Woodbridge, New Jersey, where those offices are actually closer to where employees live and it's less costly than Manhattan. We're also going to look to take up some space across the river from downtown Manhattan in New Jersey, where we believe it makes a lot of good sense for our technology and our market regulation teams out there. But we will continue to have a footprint in Lower Manhattan, where we are today in the World Financial Center.
Well, thanks, Todd. I think that was all really interesting to learn more about the budget and where the money comes from and where the money's going. But to wrap up, I just had a couple final questions for you.
Sure.
So you've been at FINRA for a while. How has FINRA's fiscal position shifted over the time you've been here?
So certainly there is a demonstrative change in FINRA's financial position with the sale of NASDAQ. Over a couple of years, say 1999 to 2004, that's what created the reserves we have today. It's interesting in that we sold NASDAQ and collected $1.6 billion of reserves back then, and that's exactly the same amount of reserves we have today. And we've used the yield from the portfolio during that time to offset price increases, serve as that rainy day fund, and make strategic investments, as we've already covered. But that was a huge change for FINRA in terms of how we looked at our finances and how we moved forward. You know, 2008 also created a line of demarcation with respect to FINRA's finances. As we still see today, the number of firms, predominantly small firms, unfortunately, continue to decrease in numbers. And the volumes, although there's been a lot of turbulence lately, we've seen some volume increases or transaction increases, the volumes aren't what they once were. So we've pretty much have seen flat revenues for the most part since 2008, which is a long time for any business to operate in. And that's why we say, from our vantage point, we're in a no-growth industry. Yet, with the no-growth industry for revenues, our responsibilities continue to increase. So FINRA has had to really focus on running itself much more like a for-profit organization in terms of being more effective, more efficient, investing in technology rather than adding headcount, and all the things any for-profit business would look at to try to respond to a no-growth top line. And that has been challenging and rewarding all at the same time because we have not compromised our mission in doing such, nor can we or will we, because we are a mission-driven organization and we just cannot afford to compromise that in any way. So it's been a balancing of using these reserves, running the place as effectively and efficiently as we can, and effectively relying on the investment portfolio gains to the extent that we can to fund the organization. That was not the case prior to the spinoff of NASDAQ and certainly prior to 2008. I can remember the days when we generated more revenues than we actually needed to and we gave rebates back to the industry. I hope those days are ahead of us, but it's been a long time in coming since we've seen that.
So one final wrap-up for my personal curiosity. So prior to joining FINRA, you were at Marriott. That seems like a very different job. Marriott's a big international hotel chain. FINRA is a U.S.-only self-regulatory organization. How does that compare?
Great question. Two totally different worlds, both with their own sets of challenges. I can tell you, the one thing being a publicly held company as Marriott was, as an SEC registrant, we had 10Qs and 10Ks and all these filings. We had analysts and we had earnings projections and reports and all that. And it absorbed a lot of time. What I like about FINRA is you don't have to worry about that. So you can really focus on the business. You can really focus on moving the business forward in an effective and efficient way. So that's clearly one big difference. I think where there's similarities is that Marriott organization truly believed in their employees. And their operating premise was if you take care of their employees, they will then take care of your customers. And FINRA is very much the same way. If we take care of our employees, we know they'll do a good job of carrying out our mission and serving the industry and ultimately serving that retail investor. So there's a lot of similarities in terms of the focus on the employees to be successful in carrying out the job or maximizing shareholder wealth or carrying out our mission. But both of them have their challenges. I would say in one respect that the financial services industry, the rate of change has been phenomenal, which has really been challenging, ever changing and keeping you on your toes. I know the hotel industry has gone through a lot of mergers and Marriott continues to grow, which is great to see. But in many ways, the models were such that you could actually predict your demographic growth, you could predict the number of hotel rooms you needed, and you could almost see around corners in the hotel industry and kind of know where the puck is going, not the financial services industry. And not to lessen the challenges the hotel industry has today, but I'm just saying it's very difficult to see around corners in the financial services industry.
That makes sense. Technology of the financial industry is very different than it was 20 years ago. Hotel Absolutely. Rooms still mostly look the same.
So. Absolutely. Well said.
Well, thanks for joining me today, Todd. Hopefully this helps some of our listeners understand the budget summary and what it's looking to help the industry and others see into FINRA's financial position. From Washington, D.C., I'm your host, Caitlin Kiernan. If you have any questions for future guests or ideas for future episodes, let us know. You can email us at finraunscripted@finra.org. Till next time.
Please note, FINRA podcasts are the sole property of FINRA, and the information provided is for informational and educational purposes only. The content of the podcast does not constitute any FINRA rule or amendment or interpretation to such rules. Compliance with any recommended conduct presented does not mean that a firm or person has complied with the full extent of their obligations under FINRA rules, the rules of any other SRO, or securities laws. This podcast is provided as is. FINRA and its affiliates are not responsible for any human or mechanical errors or omissions. Parties may not reproduce these podcasts in any form or reference them in any publication without the express written consent of FINRA.